From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. It is nice to have you with us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Happy holidays to you. Or do you prefer Merry Christmas? Or Happy Hanukkah? Or Joyful Winter Solstice? Or Happy Not November anymore? We had a spirited discussion about the annual debate over whether to say Happy Holidays or Merry Christmas. Our interfaith panel shared their perspectives on greetings.
In this clip, you'll hear Hava Leipzig-Holzhauer, the new executive director of the Konar Center for Tolerance and Jewish Studies at Nazareth College. And she begins with her way of handling holiday greeting interactions.
I think if you know the person, so I know what you celebrate, for example. I know that Jimmy celebrates Christmas. If I see him, I want to acknowledge his tradition. I want to celebrate that with him in a way. And so I'll say Merry Christmas. If I don't know the person and I don't know much about them, then I want to maybe use a term that is more inclusive and more broad and say something like Happy Holidays, because that acknowledges that they might be celebrating some tradition, but doesn't assume what it is they're celebrating. And the second thing that brings up is part of this engagement and interaction is what the sender of the message says, right? Whether I say Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays or Happy Hanukkah or Happy Hanukkah. But it's also the recipient and how you receive it. I think we're way too often easily uprooted and upset by things. And I like to say to assume good intent. Assume that the person who is giving you the greeting maybe doesn't know. I'm in a remote part of North Carolina, and at the cash register in the grocery store, they say Merry Christmas to me. I can take that in a couple of different ways. I can be terribly offended because Christmas is not the holiday that I'm celebrating at this time of year. Or I can say Merry Christmas and know that they meant that with good intent, that they wanted to say something kind, and that's the bottom line.
I think assuming good intent is always a really wise and generous and important thing to do. And too often, especially with the way things feel polarized politically, we have stopped assuming good intent. But at the same time, my sense is that for those who would be offended if someone said Happy Holidays, I'm going to generalize. I want to be careful, but I'm going to generalize. If you're actually offended that someone said Happy Holidays, my guess is what you were hoping for is a Merry Christmas. My guess is that you self-identify as a Christian. And the problem I have is not that you want to be told Merry Christmas. That's fine. I'll say Merry Christmas to anybody. I'll say Happy Hanukkah, or I'll pronounce it however you like, Hava. I thought it was beautiful, by the way. But whatever the term people, I agree with you. I want to use the phraseology that feels comfortable. But by assuming it has to be Merry Christmas, it centers Christianity as sort of dominant or the most important, or when not everyone is a Christian, when not everyone may celebrate Christmas. And I do have an issue with people who might be offended at Happy Holidays. Do you?
I have an issue if they have the same knowledge as you just described. Mm-hmm. I think, you can't live in the US of A and not know that this is a diverse place, even if the community you might specifically live in isn't diverse. We have television, we have internet, we know that our country has a mix of people. And so another way to approach that instead of being offended might be to use it as a teachable moment and say, hey, I celebrate Christmas. You're welcome to say Merry Christmas to me. Yeah, that's how I would respond. I think it can be, and I also want to be sensitive with words, but it's easy for us as humans to go from 0 to 60 like that with our anger and our offense. And this is really a subject we're all celebrating. It's holiday time for everybody. Or, by the way, we're not celebrating. And that's okay. So if somebody gets it wrong, in your opinion, when they send you a greeting, assume good intent and use it as an opportunity, if you feel comfortable, to explain what you'd like to hear next time you come across that same person or why it makes you uncomfortable, and have a dialogue.
Next, local youth climate activists are teaming up to share their message in a number of ways. On Friday, students around the world participated in a youth climate strike, and locally, a number of young activists have joined together to form a new coalition called the New York Youth Climate Leaders. We invited some of them on the show to share their goals.
In this clip, you'll hear Celia Darling and Radesh Singh, but first, here's Liam Smith, a senior at Brighton High School, who was invited to be part of County Executive-elect Adam Bellow's transition team. He's the youngest member by far, and I asked him what that means to him.
He just wants to keep our voice involved in and what's going on and be involved in the process. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to advocate for renewable infrastructure, and I just hope to help keep climate change involved in what he's doing.
Okay. And ideally then, when he actually takes the job officially, things are a little bit more ready to roll here. I mean, because, you know, this is sort of an interesting spot where the county budget will have passed. He'll have essentially, you know, 12 months until he's got to put a budget out. But he's got a lot of work to do to try to make sure that the first year isn't just a learning on the job, nothing gets done. Yeah. What do you think can get done in year one on the county level? You think these things can happen? What can happen? I'm going to ask all three of you. Let's get specific here. What do you think can happen?
Year one? Well, definitely want the advisory board in place. And I want to see Bellow's team working with county legislators to craft a draft climate action plan. And so that's what I see year one, is a draft climate action plan that all the legislature can review and maybe even pass.
Okay. Celia, what do you want to see?
Yeah, I completely agree with Liam on that, to have the board established. And what we really want to emphasize is it's a bipartisan board, and we want to hear voices from both sides trying to create climate action in Monroe County.
You think realistically you're going to see it happen?
Yeah. I am confident, and I would like to be hopeful about that.
Okay. Pradesh?
Yeah, if you look at the proposed legislation that Legislator Wilcox submitted, the Climate Action Plan Advisory Board has 6 months to form its recommendations for this climate action plan. So in 6 months, that board must have something presented to the legislature for further review. So I am very hopeful that not only this advisory board will be created, but the recommendations that they do come up with will be aggressive in order to keep up with the CLCPA that the state passed last year, which already set very ambitious goals. So it's merely a matter of Monroe County basically getting on board with what the state has required, and that helps the wrong one in trying to draw in investments and state aid and trying to implement these solutions.
So if the county creates this advisory board and the county creates its own climate action plan and it is aggressive and serious about this, some people think that, you know, sort of the naysayers think, well, you want to be very draconian and you want to, you know, make sure that everybody lives in tiny houses and drives Flintstone cars, or you want to be much, much more practical and realistic but strong in action. What does strong, realistic action mean on the county level?
Yeah, so again, sometimes the naysayers, they would like to say, oh, do you want us to go back to the Stone Age? But that's not what we're advocating for whatsoever. We're merely advocating for building efficiencies to increase in terms of reducing a greenhouse gas emissions so that the vitality of our region could continue for the future. So some of the things that we hope to see in our climate action plan, which are outlined on our website, includes transitioning the county's fleet vehicles away from gas to going fully electric, making sure that the county operations themselves, all the buildings that they own and operate, stem from 100% renewable energy, increasing efficiency in terms of recycling and waste management, trying to divert more waste away from landfills. Another thing that we explain on our website is this thing called PACE financing, which the state passed recently, which is basically providing low-interest loans to businesses and other organizations to take out in order to invest in efficiency upgrades in their own buildings. So, and there's a variety of other things that we could do, which I'll let Liam and Celia explain as well.
Go ahead, Liam.
So PACE financing is definitely an interesting option. I think the city of Rochester recently enabled it. It's a property assessed clean energy, so basically attaches the loan to the property rather than the corporation or nonprofit. And so the county has to enable that because it's a state program that, you know, I think it's some sort of taxing body has to enable it. So that's one thing. Also, in terms of transportation, county roads and county other transportation that's controlled by the county can definitely be reformed. So more bike lanes, LED lights, definitely, instead of anything else. And just public transportation, if possible. It definitely could be expensive.
All right. Well, yes. And
yes.
Well, we all know that infrastructure investment can be more expensive. I think every time there is a start and then a stop, it's viewed as with some sort of cynicism. So what we saw in California, you know, Governor Newsom in California says, you know, they were temporarily halting rail construction for, you know, for cost reasons, among other things, not shelving it entirely. And what happens? You see
all of the people who say, well, we can't transition our infrastructure with transportation, it's too expensive, and they sort of declare victory at those moments here. You'd like to at least see it explored. Mm-hmm. What's the idea? I want to know what your generation thinks the ideal forms of or sort of mix of transportation. What should it look like in the future?
Definitely better public transportation that's more available to everybody, because at least for me, it's just not practical to use the buses here. Because
the way the routes are constructed?
Yeah, well, just and how frequently they come. They don't come very often where I live. And so that and or electric cars.
More charging stations?
Yeah, more charging stations and just more electric cars in general, which is not necessarily a government issue to get people to buy electric cars.
It's an interesting sort of mix between market and government, right?
Yeah.
Where there may be incentives, et cetera. Yeah. But Celia, for you, what does transportation look like in the future if we're doing it right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's definitely important to remember where people are located. If you're in a city, it's easy to have public transportation, even if it's not the best. But for people in more rural areas that have to go longer distances, definitely electric. And waiting for electric to go like longer and longer distances is really what we need to focus on.
If people in your generation are fortunate enough to be in a position sometime in their early adulthood when they're going to have to buy a car, are you already thinking, probably shouldn't be doing gas models, they're going to be gone at some point, or things are changing? Or is it too early and people aren't really thinking about that?
That's an interesting question. I think it's kind of early to tell. It completely depends. And it's challenging because it's slightly more expensive now. It's not always subsidized.
Up front, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
But not everybody has the means to do that. And I think what we need to do with it'll eventually get to the point where the more environmentally friendly choice is cheaper. But right now we have to just make it better so everybody, no matter your means, can make a smarter choice.
Yeah, I think that's well said. What do you think, Radesh?
It's funny. Actually, I had a conversation with our school librarian, Mr. Ennis. We've actually had a really good relationship with him. He always asks us about the activities we're doing with Brighton High School Climate Club. So recently, over the summer, he was in for a new car, and he remembered some of our talks we gave about beneficial electrification, especially with electric cars. And he made it a point to go electric for his next model. And afterwards, he came to talk to us saying, thank you, guys. You kind of pushed me to going electric. And for me, if I would get a car, I would 100% get electric, regardless of the upfront cost, because I know in the long run, the cost will go down both in carbon emissions and in economic costs with buying gas. So I definitely see people going electric and seeing the benefits of it. And I think the rest of our generation sees that as well. It's just, again, the upfront costs of buying the electric vehicle initially. Well,
next, if you don't know the name Edie Windsor, you probably should. Windsor was a pioneer in the LGBTQ rights movement, and her landmark case before the U.S. Supreme Court in 2013 helped pave the way for the legalization of equal marriage in the United States. But Windsor did not set out to be an activist. In fact, she lived most of her early adult life hiding her sexual identity. She came out in the 1950s and lived for 40 years with her partner, Thea, until Thea died in 2009. When Windsor inherited Thea's estate and sought to claim the federal tax exemption for spouses, she was prevented from doing so, according to the Defense of Marriage Act, which barred same-sex couples from being recognized as spouses. That means Windsor had to pay more than $360,000 in federal taxes.
In 2013, the Supreme Court overturned that law, and Windsor became a national celebrity. She was even a runner-up for Time magazine's Person of the Year in 2013, coming in behind Pope Francis. She was working on her memoir when she died in 2017 at the age of 88. Now her surviving spouse, her second wife, Judith Kazin Windsor, is traveling the country sharing Windsor's story. She joined us on Connections, and in this clip, she discusses one of Edie Windsor's first relationships with a woman, which she kept a secret. When Edie Windsor decided to end the relationship, her girlfriend pushed back, but they both realized that it wouldn't work. It was too dangerous to be out, they thought. They cried quietly together in a park. Evan asked Judith Kazin Windsor if she thinks times have changed for LGBTQ people. Here's what she said.
I don't think it has changed that much. I'll be honest. You know, Edie came out in the early 1950s. I can't even imagine what that was like. Like, you know, like Harry said, there was no words except for homosexual or deviant, you know. And there's a part in the book where she, you know, goes to, you know, a therapy group. Not conversion therapy, but it was a therapy group. And you had these sexual dysfunction people and philanderers and all this other stuff. And this group focused on Edie. They thought Edie had the biggest problem.
I think at one point
out of everybody.
Saying, well, it's not that you're homosexual. You just want, a matriarchal figure.
Right.
That's what you really need.
Yeah. And, we've all heard that. They're like, you just haven't met the right guy yet. But what I found interesting is, Edie, when I can't imagine coming out and being what she did and what her and Thea did in such a patriarchal society in the 1960s and her getting that diamond pin and doing, I can't even wrap my head around it. Then, I kind of came out in the 90s and I led a very similar life. My personal life and my professional life was very separate. And then, actually, I have a friend from college that I've known for over 30 years, and she has a son who is 13 years old. And we've known for a very long time. He is gay. And she said he takes on different personalities with different groups of friends. And so here we have almost a 90-year span. And this kid at 13 can't quite come out at 13. And she says he acts like himself around certain groups of people, and he acts a different way around other people.
Does that break your heart?
It does break my heart because I've known him since the day he was born. It absolutely breaks my heart.
He's 13 and struggling to
and
feel
struggling.
Like in certain
settings. He hasn't quite told her yet. And the other thing is, with Edie coming out in the 50s, 60s, 70s, people were scared, really scared. For your life and for, when they talk about how they raided bars, that's just a sentence. It goes deeper than that. They raided the bars. They arrested them. They put their names in the newspaper. They completely humiliated you and outed you. And your life was destroyed. And then there's all these other random things. And Edie carried a lot of those fears through her entire life. I tell people, when I used to come home from work and I walked into the apartment and, went over to give her a kiss hello, and if the blinds were open, she flipped out. She's like, stop it, get away from me. She'd run over.
Even then?
Close the blinds, yes.
Wow.
Close the blinds, and then she would kiss me hello. And I recently had a thing where I walked into the apartment, and it was, it was after an event, it was very quiet and very lonely. And I said, oh my God, her and Thea lived in this apartment for 50 years in fear.
So to Evelyn's point about coming out, you come out to yourself, then you may come out to friends or family, and then you've got to deal with work and society. So Edie had this, to me, the story of IBM was very interesting because Edie was a brilliant woman. And
beyond brilliant.
Working her way through IBM and described IBM when it came to women in the workplace as quite progressive. We're talking decades ago, and IBM was, willing to have women rise to the ranks, et cetera. So that was, you hit that part and you go, that's good for them. Interesting. And yet she still felt like she had to date men at the office or sort of appear to date men in the office to keep up the appearance at IBM, this ostensible bastion of progressivism that she was a heterosexual. And that's hard to square. How does that square with your experience on Wall Street and how you decided to kind of approach being out on Wall Street?
I wasn't out for the first 13 years that I was on Wall Street, and it wasn't till I moved to a different firm. And at the time, I was living with someone, and we had joint accounts and things like that. So I wouldn't say I made a big announcement, but slowly but surely, I think people around the office, started to know.
And this was in the 90s?
This would be in 2008.
Wow. And so were you nervous about doing that?
I mean, I was out.
Personally?
Personally.
Sure. But on Wall Street
at work?
Not out.
Not at all.
Were you nervous about that?
No.
By then you were not?
Yeah. By then I was not. I was old enough and, things are different. And again, it's not like I had a broadcast it.
Sure.
Or put a big pride flag on my office or do anything like that. I didn't make an announcement or anything, but I just didn't hide it either.
Let's close the week
in review with some nude photos. And I don't mean to... Yeah. It's a good thing this is an audio format. That was a lot of dead air. I don't mean to be flippant, but seriously, we had a vigorous debate about the risk and reward of sharing nudes. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi recently warned younger congressional staff not to take and share nudes. She says it's too risky, and that advice follows the resignation of California Congresswoman Katie Hill.
But some younger women pushed back, saying that Pelosi was displaying a generational divide regarding the practice of nude photos. They say that younger adult women commonly take nude photos, more often than some older women might expect. Is it a good idea? In this clip, you'll hear Dr. Pebble Krantz, the director of the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness. But first, you'll hear Megan Peterson, a bar manager and a women's studies major.
When I was single, you didn't even have to ask for it. You could just have, I mean, things would just show up in your inbox. I mean, any woman will tell you they've been sent all kinds of stuff that they're not looking for, and they've been asked for all kinds of things that they're like, I don't even know you. And we've had two conversations about maybe you asking me out for ice cream next Tuesday. Like, not really interested in getting that deep with you yet.
And they're already sending nude pics of themselves to you saying,
oh, of course.
Why don't you send something? What are we doing, guys? What are you doing?
You're like, I didn't ask to see that, but thank you.
Oh, my gosh.
It's lovely. Thank you.
What is happening? What is happening? I mean, like, has that ever worked, by the way? Does anybody know of a single case?
And I got to say, too, and I don't, it's, guys, if you're going to do it, first of all, ask. And we will tell you if we want to receive it. And sometimes we actually do want to see, all right? We want to know what we're signing up for. But... That being said, at least learn how to take a proper selfie, okay? Get your angles right.
Oh, my.
You know what you're doing
here. I told you we're going to go in a lot of different directions.
No. No, nobody wants some fuzzy shot with we can see your socks in it. Like, what's going on here?
Okay. Look at all the things.
We'll bring it back around. Sorry, guys.
But the bottom line is it is common. It is common. Particularly for men to ask women who they've never met or met through dating apps, send a nude pic.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
Very common.
So knowing that, let's talk a little bit about what if you were dropping in to a middle school or a high school classroom, a health classroom, what would you hope that you'd be hearing from a teacher when it comes to nude pictures, what's appropriate, what's not?
Well, I do hope that they would be talking about it that there would be a conversation with the kids that was both in a protected and private space for them to be able to share the things that they were worried about and meet them where they are with that. But I do think that it's important that kids know that this is not material that they are going to have complete control over. And while they should have complete control over it at this time, there is no guarantee of that. I love that picture of the frog shared every place exercise. I think that's brilliant. I also think, unfortunately, kids do need to understand that anybody in New York State who is younger than the age of either 17 or 18, forgive me, if they take a picture of themselves and they send it to somebody else, that's distribution of child pornography. And that is a federal crime. And it can be a problem in an ongoing way. So I think that that needs to be discussed. I also think that we probably need to evaluate those laws so that they're not punitive to people for something that everybody in quotes around them is doing. And we need to tell people to be sensible about that because it can ruin a life. I mean, it's terrible.
So a couple of things here. First of all, Megan, from your own experience, we're just taking a guess here. Let's say you've got a couple of 17-year-olds in a consensual high school dating relationship.
Sure.
And the girl in this case sends nude pictures to her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
What are the odds that he shows nobody?
probably 10%.
Okay.
I mean, the first thing that a high school boy is going to turn around and do is go, hey, guys, look. He may not send it. Because then he'll have a paper trail.
No, but he may show it.
But he'll show it, probably.
So just knowing the reality of our experience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, Dr. Krantz, is it appropriate for a health teacher to tell students, never do this, there is never a good reason to do this?
Oh, I don't want to answer that question.
It's different if they say never do it right now. You're underage. Right.
Yeah.
It's another to say in life, there's never a good reason. This is not something anyone should be doing.
I think that would be an inappropriate message. Never in life is an inappropriate message. Don't do it right now because it could have significant consequences socially and legally. Mm-hmm. Yes. But never in life, it just, that doesn't acknowledge the complexity of people's sexual experience.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM, unless there are more impeachment hearings.
Yeah, sorry about that, everybody. But we'll be back.
Thanks, Washington.
You can also listen to us on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan. He's Evan. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.